Right.
Okay, we're back on the air. And except that the...
There we go.
All right. So anyway, there are these equations, and basically what they're saying is you can write this S thing, selection differential, in terms of the overall variance and the derivative of the log of the mean fitness. I won't try to explain how all that works. When you put this stuff in, what you get out is that the response can also be thought of as the additive genetic variance times the slope of the log of the mean fitness. Okay, well, why is that of any interest? It's because here is exactly, this is exactly responsive to the question I was just asked. A very common form of natural selection in nature has got to be optimal selection, in which there's a phenotype, but if you plot the fitness of individuals that have different phenotypes, they will follow some sort of a curve that goes up, has an optimum, and comes down. Because it just doesn't make sense to say, maybe my finger should be some optimal length, but you don't want it to be 10 feet long. That would be bad for fitness, and you don't want it to be 2 millimeters long. So somewhere in between is an optimum. That's you know, going to be a very, very common pattern. Now, it's convenient when drawing it to draw it as if it's a normal distribution, because the math works out nicely. There is no guarantee that that's really true in nature. So if we say to ourselves, well, let's imagine a selection where there's an optimum, P, there's a scale X, which is the character. Fitness, this curve, is proportional to a normal distribution. That really means it will have the form e to the minus the square of the departure from the mean, from the optimum, divided by a constant. And this constant is a kind of pseudo variance of this distribution. It's not really a variance because this isn't a distribution. This is a fitness curve. But it comes in, and it shows you how fitness drops away as you depart from the as x departs from the optimal. Well, if you happen to have that pattern, if you happen to have this Gaussian-looking fitness curve, and then you say, okay, let's apply Russ Landy's formulas, or let's just go directly and compute. Let's put a normal distribution of individuals down on this scale. Apply this fitness to them and ask what happens to that distribution. And the answer turns out to be just doing multiplying a couple of these squared exponential things together and collecting stuff and completing the square. And then you end up with the following. It says that the mean of the distribution of phenotypes, not shown here, the mean is right here. The mean changes, and it changes in a direction towards the optimum. That's not a very big surprise. And it changes furthermore by taking how far the optimum is from you. Like if the optimum is 1 gram heavier than you, this will be 1 gram, and says the mean is going to change in that direction. Not all the way, but this departure times something. And the times something is the additive genetic variance of the trait over the phenotypic variance. If you just had those two, that's the heritability. But the denominator actually has this VS thing added in. So what it means is that a very wide selection curve, the VS is very large, but that's a very shallow, that's very weak selection. So if VS gets large, that's weak selection. The denominator gets big. The fraction gets small. You don't move as much towards the optimum. If VS is very, very small, you go towards the optimum by multiplying by the heritability. You might think you go all the way to the optimum. After all, if it's very narrow, everybody dies except individuals that are sitting in the optimum. But here we're talking about the next generation. Even though you save only those, even if you have very strong selection, you save only those individuals sitting right on the optimum, their offspring won't be there. They'll be spread out in between, depending on the heritability. So this takes that into account. So basically what you got in this simple-minded, rather idealized optimum selection scheme is that the phenotype is moving every generation a constant fraction of the way towards the optimum from either side. The phenotype, it's trying to climb, trying, flashing quotes to teleology language, watch out, it's trying to climb to the peak of the fitness of the fitness landscape, the adaptive landscape, the fitness optimum. And that's what you get out of quantitative genetics. It's basically quantitative genetics in the end says that each character will be trying to climb the fitness curve. Now, if you have, I should say before I go further, if you have multiple characters, it'll do it in multidimensional space. And it will, there will be correlations between the characters, and the shape of the fitness curve can also look like it's correlated, and that all comes in, and there is some path that you get, but it's headed for the optimal. And I won't try to give the rules there. So if you've got a fitness optimum sitting there somewhere, and you've got genetic drift, and you've got mutation, what you would see is, if there is no selection, you'll see Brownian motion. And so if I have a character, and I have several different lineages, several different populations, and they're each undergoing genetic drift independently, then they will do independent Brownian motions. And here I've simulated, here's the starting point. There's no optimum because there's no selection here. If I impose selection with one of these Gaussian fitness functions, what you get is a rather different process. It looks like Brownian motion. In fact, if you look closely here, you will see that all the little wiggles here are the same, pretty much the same as all the little wiggles there. That's because when I ran these processes, I used the same sequence of random numbers. So they're, in a sense, undergoing the same genetic drift. But what's happening over here is, in addition to that, there's a selective pull towards an optimum, and I happen to have set up the optimum to also be the starting point. Those are two different concepts, where you start and where the optimum is, but we're making them the same just for the sake of the numbers here. So they start to wander away, but they get pulled constantly towards this optimum value on the character scale. And that's a process called an Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process, which was invented by two physicists around 1930 for completely different purposes, for purposes of talking about velocities and accelerations of particles in viscous solutions, nothing to do with the biological example. And basically what it just is a Brownian motion that is continually having a sort of linear force pulling it towards the optimum. It's the random jumping around of a particle that's heat in above absolute zero with some temperature, except the particle is attached to an optimum by a rubber band. And so the further away it gets, the more it gets pulled back towards this post where it's tied by an elastic band. So natural selection with a constant fitness peak looks like, is supposed to look like this, not that. This is without selection. Things will wander farther and farther away. This one, they spread out to a limit, and then they sort of settle into a limiting variance. They gradually settle into a limiting variance. And the OU process, the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process, is the one people are widely using for this in order to think about characters under natural selection. Interesting enough, I saw a blog post by Jerry Coyne, well-known evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago, and he happened to mention that when he was in graduate school, he worked for Uhlenbeck. Although all he did for Uhlenbeck was help him clear out his office and carry some boxes, so he didn't, there's not much intellectual connection there. Okay, so that's the kind of process that we're thinking of for natural selection. But let's go a little further. If the peak moves, then you have to think what will happen. What will happen is, here is the fitness curve. Here is this particle on the side of the fitness curve is trying, in some sense, to get to the peak. But the problem is that the peak keeps shifting. So we have, owing to changes, for example, the temperature in the environment might be changing through time, not just in yearly cycles, but from year to year there might be a different average temperature. And so a character that's under selection to adapt to the temperature may find its optimum shifting all the time. And so what you'll have is a process that's doing two things. It's climbing the peak, and then the peak keeps moving out from under it. And so it's chasing the peak, and the peak is wandering. Now, ultimately, if you wait long enough and observe that process, if the peak wanders a good distance, the particle will go with it. In fact, what you can show is under this scheme, the particle doesn't get further and further away from the peak. It gets towed behind. It's on the end of that elastic band, but the peak is moving, and so it's wandering back and forth around the peak. And if the peak is moving, say, in this direction, it'll tend to be lagging a little bit behind, but it will not get very far behind because the power, the force pulling it is very strong. So in the long run, it goes where the peak goes, which is an interesting fact. To show you this, let's see. Oh, yeah. First, I've got to talk about correlations of characters for a bit, and then I'll show you a simulated example of chasing an adaptive peak. So when you ask how correlated will be the motions of two characters or three characters or 10 characters, we have to think about a couple of reasons why those characters will change in covarying ways, in correlated ways. One I've already told you about is if there's genetic drift, then the additive genetic covariation will tend to the pattern of change in the characters will tend to reflect the additive genetic covariances, if genetic drift is the only thing going on. In other words, if height and weight are correlated, as they are for developmental reasons, that's also reflected in them being genetically covariant with each other. Genes that increase your height are also increasing your weight on average. And that will be reflected in where they wander in phenotype space. But there's a second reason, and that's the one I've got to talk about for a few minutes, because it's something that is a very important concept that almost nobody talks about. It's been talked about since 1926, and it is selection the response to selection will depend upon the additive genetic covariation, because we've seen the genetic variance affects how quickly you respond to selection, but also with something called the covariation of the selection pressures, also called
the number of selections acting.
I wouldn't say number of, but here I'm going to give you an example. And it's called, it was originally called selective correlation. You could also call it selective covariance. It's the covariation of the selection pressure. In other words, if natural selection is trying to suppose natural selection is trying to increase my height but decrease my weight, that will be not what the genetic covariance is doing, but it could result in a response in which my height increases and my weight decreases. The example I'm going to use here is a little more dramatic. I imagine a phylogeny, and you have some lineages, and they're evolving. And these species are in different parts of the globe. Three of them are in temperate regions, and two of them, the lineages have gone into the Arctic. And in the Arctic lineages, we see, in this lineage which went into the Arctic, we see that size increases, color gets darker, and limb length gets shorter. In this one, we see similar changes. Size gets bigger, color gets darker, and limb length gets shorter. Now, if we only knew about genetic covariates and didn't know about selective covariates, we would look at it and say, oh, you know, there must be a genetic correlation. It must be that the same alleles that increase your size make your color darker, make your limb length relatively shorter. Maybe that's a genetic covariation, because look, when these change in different parts of the tree, there's independent evidence that those things are changing together. Okay. Well, no, those are called Bergman's, Allen's, and Glogler's rule. Bergman's rule is for the size, Allen's is for, I think Allen's is limb length, and Glogler's is color. I think I have those slightly in wrong order there. And the rationale is that natural selection wants you to be bigger if you're in the Arctic, so that your surface to volume ratio is lower and you will lose less heat, less of your body heat. It wants your color to be darker, except when you're trying to be cryptic in the snow. Color to be darker so you can absorb more solar radiation, and it wants your limb lengths relatively shorter, again, so that your surface to volume ratio will be smaller. So those are responses to three different selective pressures. And the fact that they are co-occurring on the tree is simply because those two lineages went into the Arctic. So there's at least a selection, a selective rationale here, which is to say that that correlation of those three traits may be the result of selective covariance, and there may not be any genetic covariance between those traits. There need not be any. Yeah.
So are all three of those different selective pressures? Or because it sounds like they're all responses to cold, and then they just have...
Yeah, they are. So it's six of one and half a dozen of the other. You can call them different or you can call them similar. But I don't think it changes the situation to call them the one or the other. Okay. This concept of selective covariance was actually invented by a Danish animal breeder, Olaf, Danish, I think, plant evolutionist named Olaf Hedin, who... In 1926, in a paper in German, in the plant breeding, in I think Hereditas, and it was picked up by Ledyard Stebbins in 1950 in his great book Variation and Evolution in Plants, which was one of the great volumes of the modern synthesis. It was one of the great summaries of the modern synthesis, and considered one of the sort of five big books that did that. In the middle there somewhere, he says, and there's there's selective correlation, the Tedin concept that Tedin introduced. Well, let's think about what selective correlation would be. In a case where you have an optimum that is itself wandering, let's imagine two characters. And we imagine an optimum, it's just a circularly symmetrical optimum, sitting right here on the intersection of the two dotted lines. And we imagine a trait that is starting to, that is undergoing genetic drift. And we also imagine that the genetic covariances are negative. In other words, if I do the contour of the genetic covariances, they are going to be, they're going to look like this. So this is the genetic, the contours called the additive genetic variation. Okay. Now, if the optimum didn't move, what you will see is variation will, genetic drift will tend to occur in this direction. And it will continually be pulled back towards the optimum. This is a lineage evolving according to an Ornstein-Uhlenbeck, a two-dimensional Ornstein-Uhlenbeck model here, in which the variants of the little displacements due to genetic drift are in this tend to be preferentially in this direction and less in that direction.
So over time, it would get longer and less.
It would. No, it will get longer up to a limit, and then it will kind of won't get any longer after that because the selection is keeping it from going too far. But what's really happening here is I didn't just keep the optimum the same. I had it wander, and I made it do a Brownian motion too, although that's not a result of genetic drift. The optimum is caused by the interaction of the phenotypes of the environments in some way. We don't really have a mathematical model for how the optimums change unless we understand the complete functional ecology of everything. And what I did is make the optimum go this way. So it will change more in this direction than in that direction. So the optimum is going to be doing that. The first 100 generations are plotted here. The next 1,000 generations, well, I think this is the change every 10 generations for the first 1,000, so that first 100 is in there somewhere. Now what's happening is the fact that the optimum is moving is starting to smear things out this way too, and if you go to the first 10,000 generations and take every 100 generations, you find that they're smearing out a lot this way. So what's happening here is the additive genetic variation wants you to change this way a lot more than the other, but the selective covariance as reflected in the movements of the optimum wants you to change in this positively correlated way. And if you wait long enough, you're basically chasing the optimum. And the effect of the genetic variance will be relatively small, unless there's zero of it. You'll get towed behind the optimum. How far behind you are depends on how much genetic variation you have and how strong the selection is. So this is just to kind of give you a feeling for two sources of the ways that quantitative characters can covary in evolution. And the second one, I keep emphasizing selective covariance, remember that, because you will go forth into the world and you will run into people who say that when two characters change in a correlated fashion, that's because of genetic variation, period, stop. And they are wrong. Okay. And there are a lot of them. Okay. You actually have people talking about this who don't use the phrase selective covariance or selective correlation. They should. Yeah.
So in this figure, the axes are like
two characters.
Okay, yeah. And
it's some scale. I didn't bother to put units or names
right
on them because I didn't need them.
The optimum is moving only in this positive correlate?
No, it's undergoing a Brownian motion of its own, but with a preference to go northeast to southwest.
Okay.
But it does some in the other direction, too.
Okay. And the genetic covariances being negative are like the starting kind of
the genetic covariance that the jumps that are made under Brownian under genetic drift tend to be a little more this way than that way, and that's true throughout the whole process.
Is that a product of the two traits, or like the underlying genetic, or just like?
It's this phenomenon
process
that I talked about at the beginning, where the genetic covariances that the change, if you just allow genetic drift and didn't have any selection, you will take the genetic covariance distribution and kind of blow it up. it'll change more in, let's see, from your point of view, that's a negative change, yeah. It'll change more this way than that, simply because there are more alleles that are able to change you in the one way than the other. There's okay. more mutations are occurring that change you that way than change do the negatively correlated way. But in spite of that, the whole thing is under selection, being towed by optima, and if the optima are changing in a differently correlated way,
that will pull.
In the long run, they're actually going to win out in this simple model. Okay.
Are there instances, and if this is irrelevant, shut me up, where people will select optimums for more than two characters, like this is two characters, but then they have other optimums for those characters, and then they start pulling those together in the analysis to look at overlaps of relations, or is that irrelevant to this?
I am not sure what you're asking.
So earlier we were discussing the principal components, and maybe we varied away from that, and my understanding is just incorrect, but on the same plot, would you ever have other optimums with two characters and then seeing if those would overlap in the area they're covering to see if there is relation in the change that you're looking at? Does
you
that
mean,
make...
You're asking whether, in addition to this optimum, which is wandering around, could there be another optimum?
Yeah, and then maybe
and then you're wanting
another
to know,
set of
well,
characteristics.
There's issues how they change relative to each other and
yeah.
how close they are and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, all that you can imagine.
Okay.
And life gets harder. The math gets a little less simple.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't do it here.
Okay.
But yeah, you can imagine all sorts of crazy spaces with all sorts of placements of optimal, but the issue would be what's likely to occur in real life. Yeah.
If you have a trait in an organism, now, that changes its optimum depending on environmental conditions, just within
yeah.
the organism, could you use these models to look at these sorts of questions?
So are you saying that, let's say I'm sitting here, I'm fine, I'm well adapted, I've got nice characters, I'm near some.
Right.
Suddenly, the temperature changes, and
yeah.
it really would be better if I were over here in phenotype space.
Yes, and
yeah,
you can
sure.
literally do that because of your biology.
If you're too far away from it, you go extinct. Your fitness
right.
is too close to zero. You don't have enough reproductive excess to fight that fitness. If it's close enough, you'll suddenly start. You'll suddenly find yourself on the end of a long rubber band, and
sure.
you start getting pulled to that optimum.
Sure, but I mean, experimentally, could we test these things if we had traits which were already really plastic in an organism?
You could imagine putting organisms whose genetic variations, whose means and variances and covariances you know, into a situation
yeah.
where you have some kind of control over the environment and could therefore...
Yes.
Yeah. But in a lot of cases, we don't know quite enough. I mean, we can do it in a computer with a mathematical model and do anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
But in real life, to test it with real organisms, you have to know an awful lot about that organism, a lot about the genetic covariation. And a lot about the shapes, how fitness changes as the phenotype changes. Usually those are things we're trying to desperately to find out with indifferent success. So, you know, only if you knew a lot could you sort of do a control test like that. Yeah.
The question is, so for phylogenetic inference, does that mean because of this you have to somehow encode the environment each sample came from?
Mm. If you knew enough to know what aspects of the environment to measure, yes. If. That's a big if. Unfortunately, this department, for example, is into high-throughput genomics of all sorts, proteomics of all sorts, epigenomics of all sorts, metabolomics of all sorts, but the one thing we're not into is into it. Well, I could use the word environomics, but it's already been taken by environmental economists. What nobody has done is made a machine that goes out and measures the environment. What they have is a thermometer. You ask anybody about the environment, and they say, oh, you mean the temperature. You know, I don't just mean the temperature. There's a lot more to it than that. But that's the first thing everybody knows how to measure. So we're at the end of our time. Where we're headed is a little more discussion of that, and then we're going to get into comparative methods and how you use a phylogeny that you got from some other means, i.e. molecular means, and you look at quantitative characters on that phylogeny, and you try to infer the covariance of changes, which then is to be interpreted in terms of these concepts. And we're once again falling a little behind, but I think in a good way, so we'll go on from there. I will post the recording, which won't contain some bits of the first part of the lecture.
Chair, sure, let's ask, going back to